Good day, Vashon Mori Island. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm so glad you've joined us today here at our island's own Voice of Vashon on 101.9 FM, KVSHLP Vashon. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, a conversation-style interview show highlighting authors from around the world who seek in their own creative way to inspire all of us to be the best we can be. And now, on with the show. All right, so Kathleen, thank you so much. We finally made this happen.
Thank you for having me.
And you are calling in from Pennsylvania?
Yes, I'm a Northeast PA girl.
So I'm a little familiar with the state. Where are you in the state?
Well, I'm by the Hazleton area. I'm in one of those little teeny tiny towns around it. Pennsylvania is full of like teeny tiny little coal miner towns.
Yes.
Yes. So I live in Freeland, Pennsylvania. But my family originally came from New York. So I have a lot of New York flavor in my life. And yes, I'm a graphic designer turned fiction writer, kind of by accident. It's actually a pretty big state. Like, I've actually never been to Pittsburgh. And
oh my God, I've been to Pittsburgh. Dang, girl.
It's like 4 hours from me, so it's a commitment.
Oh, you are so East Coast.
I know.
Oh my gosh. Oh, you're like, that's like European. Really? No, seriously. East Coast people, Europeans, they're like, you know, oh, I have to drive 4 hours. Oh, and I'm like, yeah, like I did that last weekend.
I know. We're all like in our little, my sister lives 20 minutes away from me and she's like, oh, I have to drive down this weekend. And I'm like, even that feels far. There's something about the roads, man.
Well, I don't know now, like maybe it's because you're growing up around, you know, horses and buggies. And so it puts everything in context.
Maybe.
Seriously.
Well, Amish at heart. That's where we come from.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny.
Such a weirdo.
I mean, I'm sorry. Like, I've been up and down California. I live in Seattle. But, you know, West Coasties, we drive. What can I say? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, then. All right, cool. So, So thank you for grounding us a little bit in who you are and what you do. And let's see here. Folks, I asked Kathleen to join me on the show because, okay, a couple of reasons. First, she's really fun on Twitter. Second, because you fairly quickly, in like a couple of years, were like, I think I'm going to become a novelist. And then you were. And you not only are that, but you landed a 5-book deal. So yes, fellow writers out there, we are going to pick Kathleen's brains and try to figure out some tips and ideas on how to make that a success that many of us can have. So, like, seriously, Otherworldly series, wow. How long were you thinking about this?
Oh, well, the story concept actually started when I was 12 and I was bored. I think if my whole life revolved around movies and the years of like from like 2001 to about 2004, if you look at like the kind of movies that came out, they were terrible. So I had nothing to really kind of entertain myself with. And it just kind of kept rolling around my head for years and years. And I kept adding to it and changing. Thank goodness it changed because I can imagine the 12-year-old version of it was terrible.
Or excellent for 12-year-olds.
I can remember little snippets and I'm like, oh, no. I went to college for graphic design and had all the intentions of making it into a webcomic. And I had a couple pages done and lost steam. And I actually had something happen to me after I graduated. I was working a series of disastrous office jobs. My insurance got dropped. I had to get off a certain medication and a depression lifted that I didn't even know I had. And literally about 2 or 3 days later, I'm like, I need a pen and a notepad. I have a story I have to write now.
Wow.
And I think I might have written the first draft in maybe a month under or something. It just popped into existence.
Yeah. So you had an unexpected event that caused you to have to give up on a medication, which you then realized had actually been inhibiting you.
Yes. Yeah. I had no idea. I had other events going on. Like I had just graduated college. I couldn't find a graphic design job. Things were stressful. And I just assumed it was that. But and I was even very upset. I was like, oh, I have to change medications. And then I realized I didn't realize it was making me depressed until I was like, I feel like a completely different person, and I have all this energy, and I am creative. And it just came all came back, and I was really happy.
Oh, I'm really happy to hear that. That's yay. And now we all get to benefit because honestly, I mean, standalones, I'm actually interviewing someone who's written a standalone in a couple of weeks, and that's fine. I forgive her in advance. But, and then you have a duology, which just sort of like you're like, oh, you get this pain in your chest because at the end of a second book, you're just going to be so sad. There's not more. Trilogies, you start to feel a little bit better, but five book series, someone can really feel like, oh, I can invest myself because you are investing as well, and we're going to be together for a while. And so this is exciting. When you were querying your, and let's see, otherworldly is sort of the term for your series. And so when you were querying this, did you query it as, hey, I've got five books, which sort of goes against all the advice out there? Or were you querying it as book one? And by the way, I'll barely mention I have some other books. How did you do that?
I believe when I queried with actual agents, we'll get back into the actual publishing side, because that happened really oddball off the way too.
Cool.
I think I pitched it as a trilogy. It was supposed to be a trilogy in my head for the longest time. It was, but the first book is very kind of cut and dry. It could be a standalone thing if needed, but I set up a lot of questions that you'd be like, wait a minute, you didn't explain. So,
Right.
the second and third installments didn't follow a traditional plot. They had like multiple different climaxes, and it was just very information heavy. So once I started talking to my actual publisher, they were very kind of honest with me, and they said like, "Does this have potential for more books?" And I got the impression that they actually wanted more. And I was like, "Are you sure?" Because again, I had read like the research about like don't push for too much at once.
Right.
But plot wise, I'm so glad I cut them. I got like books two and three into like two, three, four, and five, and it works
Right.
so much better for the plot.
Sure. I think that probably one of the big exciting secrets that a lot of early writers don't know about is that there can be a lot of joy rather than just killing your babies, which sorry, folks, we don't actually mean that. It means, your darlings, whatever. It's like things that you fell in love with that you think are just really great and have to be in the story, and people are trying to convince you to remove it. So it's called killing your babies. But I think that a lot of people have this impression that there will be this painful experience of having to go through that. But for me personally, I have found that sometimes changing something after you've been working on a draft multiple times for many years, actually is very freeing and very exciting and very inspirational and very wonderful. So it sounds like for you, instead of them saying, hi, I want you to change everything, and you went home and sobbed into your pillow, instead you're like, oh, really? Can I? That's awesome. Is that true?
Yes. It was a little, I was like very timid about what steps I should take for it, because I knew in my heart, I'm like, this is going to be a long book. And even just the physical, like if it's printed, I'm like, that spine's going to get funny because it's going to be too thick.
Right,
So I
right,
knew
right.
there was something slightly wrong, but I didn't know how to do it until like they kind of gave me permission to be like, maybe we should break up the books. And even then, I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. And I'm always surprised about maybe if you have a hole in your plot or something, or you have to change a scene and you're really apprehensive about doing it, just write it. And if it's garbage, just throw it away and try again. But sometimes just writing it, you'll take a break, come back to it, and you're like, that works so much better than I thought originally. And it's such a gift. It's
Right.
so nice.
Right. Which someone recently, I don't know, well, you've heard of the Manuscript Academy?
I haven't. I haven't read
Oh.
them.
Oh my gosh. Okay, check them out.
I'm a
They're awesome.
newbie. I'm sorry.
I know, so am I to a degree. So I listen to their podcast when I'm out on walks. I just throw on my headset and off I go. And the most recent one was this woman who made this comment. She said, don't ever throw anything away. She creates an outtake folder. That's what she calls it, right? And she says, like you had just mentioned, you know, something's total crap, you know, toss it, but toss it into the outtake folder. And then later, you know, when it comes back to you, you go, oh, part of the, you know, so I think that for like, she has like 41 books published. So this woman has been doing this for a while and she has an outtake folder for each book. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a great idea.
That's actually very good. Cause what I'm realizing with this, series, I had written the first book, had my son. And, while I like the first couple months, you know, that's always rough. I couldn't write. I just physically didn't have it in me, but my brain was going wild and I ended up making so many concepts that I am so excited to get to once this series is underway. Mm-hmm. But most of those concepts are a little bit of like a seed I tried out in the series and decided it didn't work. And I put it away somewhere, like mentally or filed it away. Mm-hmm. And so I find it very interesting to hear it often where like, one movie was a concept from another movie and it didn't work and then someone picked it up again and it turned into something different. And yeah, definitely recycle your ideas. It's a good time.
Well, and you're lucky that you're young enough to be able to actually, as you said, store them away in your thoughts. I'm like, yeah, no, if I've gone 48 seconds without writing it down, woo, that sucker's gone. So for others of us, you know, we'll write it down, but you just go on memorizing it. Okay. So the value of being youthful. All right.
Oh, it's only selective. Trust me. I couldn't find my phone forever and I found it in the fridge. So. It's only with like, usually with plots. My mom calls me up for like, what happened in this one specific movie in like 1975? And I'm like, oh, I know the plot exactly, but I can't tell you what I had for breakfast, things like that.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I totally get it. Okay. So Otherworldly, 5 books. The current one is being played around with. Titles are not you know, carved into stone yet. You're talking about The Skeleton Key as a title for book one. Yes. What can you tell us about your story that is not going to get you in trouble? Because I'm actually curious. What I mean by that is not just spoiler alert. What I mean is, as an author who has contracted with an agent, with editor, with publisher, and all that, what type of rules might come into play with regard to, you know, don't send it out to beta readers anymore. We don't want it out there in the ethos. Or don't talk about this. You think, you know, like actors, when they're being interviewed and they'll suddenly throw their hand on their mouth because they mentioned something about a Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, movie going to be launched and everyone's staring at them like, you just broke a massive contract. What limits may or may not be out there?
They did tell me to stop beta reading because when we were deciding the deadlines, I was like, oh my goodness, do I have to factor in like the betas to read it? Because, you know, that could be like either a very quick process or that can take months.
Right.
So they said only for the, well, probably to keep it, you know, contained. Mm-hmm. But they wanted me to stop beta reading just so I can work exclusively with an editor who will know the story inside and out.
Yes.
Sometimes, oh, there's such an adventure of beta reading. And I did this all before, you know, I started querying and signed the contract where you'll hand it to one person. They'll go, oh, the first chapter works. And then you hand it to a second person. They're like, oh, it's completely garbage. Throw it away. And I'm like, oh,
I know. What do you do with that? Oh.
What you do is you go with your gut instinct and then just instincts. Sorry.
Yes.
You go with your gut instincts and then, you know, maybe they'll be right later on. And if not, you just move on. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Totally get that. All right, mm-hmm. Cool. So then what can you tell us about this story?
Mm-hmm. Shall I read the blurb?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. I'm going to be all official about it.
Yes.
Okay. For 21 years, Rain Parker's biggest problem were deciding which cooking shows to watch and how to best avoid her cold corporate mother in their chic Manhattan apartment. A privileged daughter of New York's elite, Rain is hardly the person to depend on in a crisis. When the purchase of a rusted old thimble sends her hurtling into an alternate realm, Rain is forced to find and release a deadly monster. Should she fail, she'll meet the sticky end at the hands of a sadistic witch with secrets of her own. Tiptoeing the line between enchanted and disturbed, Rain must fight her way through a hostile land filled with magic, intrigue, and a whole lot of bloodshed if she ever wants to find a way home again. That is, if there is a way.
I really like that last part.
Thank you.
all sorts of stuff is going on. And let's see, I was lucky enough that even though I'm not a beta reader for you, you got permission for me to see like the first few chapters. And that blurb makes it feel almost like it's, what's the word for it? Not, what's the word we use when we're describing, fairy tale slash fantasy-esque, you know, it has a sort of a feeling like that. And yet, you know, of course you start in that fancy apartment. And I think it's so fascinating how she doesn't call her mom, mom.
No.
You know, and so let's delve in a little bit to some of the relevancy that the story is going to have for readers, the issues that are human, that are occurring in the real world right now that come into your story. There's all the fun fantasy stuff you've created. That's great. But functionally, you have themes that are deeply human.
Oh, yeah.
So
sure.
do these topics, did they attract you because you've seen them in other places? Do you have personal experience with these things?
I suppose I started writing it because I talk about my husband all the time, but he has a lot of friction in his family. And I had opposed to that, I have a very nurturing family, and coming together, I'm working out some issues that I empathize with him with. And I ended up in the story somehow. When I first started to create this story, I thought it would be new adult. It turns out it's totally an adult story, but I thought it would be new adult for the reasons that new adult kind of is geared towards adult to about 18 to 25 who are leaving home and finding their home life. So,
yeah, college age.
Yeah. So she's at that cusp where she actually has a very fiction filled relationship with her mother, but she's also trying to find herself. And it's also made doubly hard because she was raised by her grandmother who had died, and she's at home with the mother who doesn't really understand her. So she's wants to disconnect, and it's a very scary thing for her. So she's right on the cusp of being independent.
Mm-hmm. And these are obviously themes that a lot of people can relate to. It's a challenging time. I remember when my kids were early teenagers talking to my my stepmother, who used to do like youth counseling, and she's a life coach, and she's really amazing. And I remember her saying, well, now I just want you to know that, you know, you think it's tough right now, your kid's 13, 14, whatever. And she's like, but you know, you're going to have to make it to the late 20s here, honey. She's like, you know, it's not like they hit 18, 19, it's all smooth sailing. She's like, especially for boys, you know, but I think for everyone, those early 20s to mid 20s, those are massively important period of time. And yet it's interesting because at the same time, when so much is going on, it's going on in the absence of the parents, because that's actually how the child is able to fully reach out and grip onto their own life, because, you know, and so, yeah, new adult boy, that I don't know how I feel about having more genres that split up the ages or not, but I do wish new adult was maybe a little bit more empowered and not faltering so much, because what a powerful time. We shouldn't be ignoring this incredibly powerful time in life.
Certainly. And I think part of me tipped it into adult just because the characters grow throughout the series. It does continue to have those themes of growing and finding yourself, not just for Rain, the main character, but there's a secondary character named Hollow who has similar struggles where he's also trying to find out where he fits in this world. And it's exciting. And maybe it's also continues to be an adult problem too, because who hasn't had a step back and like had to question, is this the career I want? Am I on the right path? So maybe it's a distinctive all around, not just adult issue, but human.
Yeah. No, I mean, oh my gosh, absolutely. And so let's see here. You said that there were most of us have events in our own life that sort of inspire us. And you were starting to think about the story back when you were 12, but but you were interested in doing graphic design. You are very artistic. And then somehow you sort of intentionally segued over to focusing on the story. And now you've got a child. there are so much going on in your life right now. It's a very busy period for you, isn't it?
I have been busy. That's very true. Yeah, it's very exciting, and I'm realizing what's exciting for me is as I have a 2-year-old, and I'm starting to introduce him to all kinds of like old movies that I really loved, and I'm realizing how those old movies impacted my work. And I'm like, oh, there's so much from Return to Oz in this series. It's not even funny. That's I forgot the question. I'm so sorry.
No,
I didn't pause either. Oh.
The question wasn't actually very clear. It was more like just a general conversational point. So, so there is a lot going on. You've had inspiration for this story coming out of your own life events. And let's talk about the theme of superior people and outcasts, that sort of whole othering issue, classism, so on and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, within the series, it's set up so the human race in this fantasy world is superior. Due to a war, they kind of rose above the rest. And there are numerous other races of supernatural creatures, just collectively known as others. And our main character is human, so she goes to this world and where she, if she's so inclined, could be a part of that superior race. But the people she ends up knowing and loving and creating relationships with are these supernatural beings. And she begins to look at the idiocy of prejudice. And I suppose the series it not only like calls out the faults in that system, but if you're a part of that system and you're benefiting from it, is it harmful? And what do you intend to do about it? Mm-hmm. So that's a big theme of the series.
All of that ties in extraordinarily well in the United States of America with the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Is it good enough to just say, I'm not being mean to people? Or do we recognize our white privilege? Do we do something actively and intentionally to correct, the lack of white privilege that people who aren't white live with? There's a lot packed in there. I'm so excited to get to meet these different people. You refer to some of them as monsters?
Well, some are a little on the physical side as monsters. Some can look completely human, just collectively known as others. Yeah.
And this is in the other world. So it's like you've got this duology between, you've got this normal human world, and then there's that, Alice falls down the rabbit hole and lands in the other world.
Yes, there's an alternate world, and there's discussions of multiple, universes, so to speak, and realms. It's just multiple layers. And if you get into like the metaphys of it, it's so exciting. I love that aspect of things.
Right. I know, like people who write sci-fi, a lot of people who read sci-fi might think that it just comes out of pure imagination, but a lot of sci-fi comes, it's just an extenuation of
what we
take the real and then we go with it.
Yeah. But I think I've taken this series kind of unintentionally, used it to talk about issues that have always bugged me. For instance, when I was in high school, I had this lovely group of friends who were so talented and beautiful, but I did notice they were very harshly bullied. So much so, I never even really saw the bullying. They would just tell me about what had happened or who's picking on them. And I've come to realize it would never happen to me, and it would never happen in front of me. And I couldn't figure it out until I realized they had nothing really to pick on me about. And that is a privilege that was like heaped onto me. And it made me very angry and uncomfortable, because I'm like, if you're gonna pick on odd kids, pick on me. I'm very weird. And then it would give me an excuse to engage and find a solution. And it was always very troubling to me, because I felt like, I'm like, if you're gonna pick on everyone, pick on everyone.
Right.
And then I get to realize, I grew up and I realized it's because of like, there is like a privilege of it. I suppose it's a white privilege, and what to do with that heaped on top of me, and it makes me very uncomfortable. And I wrote a story about that again. And sometimes it's hard to look at this issue without having the story turn into a white savior story. That's something I pay very close attention to, and hopefully, steer away from, because there's so many other characters in here that rise above, and not to simplify a situation based on prejudice, but rather explore it, and it's a backdrop for a more character-driven series, but it's still an important issue.
Oh yeah, no. I mean that's it's so challenging right now. There's so much change going on and recalibrating and adjustment. So I just appreciate that you're aware of all that and you're doing your best to try to be conscious and actively engaged in
It's heavy. It's heavy stuff.
The problem is there's not even like a settled, new way of doing things yet. There's still things are filtering around and adjusting and being discussed. And so the beauty is that in the midst of all that, you have awareness of self, awareness of others, and well, awareness of the community, and you're being as aware and then sensitive and cautious and thoughtful as you can be. And that's all we can really ask of people right now. And I think a lot of writers are facing that and trying to figure out how do you adjust so that you are a force for good,
Change.
so to speak. Change. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Sure, definitely. And I felt like the need to write the story because I know there's other people struggling with the same thing, like not only the oppressed, but the people who are higher up in, like, I don't want to say the food chain, but I mean like this hierarchy that is created around us. What do you do with that? And there's like, I feel like there's two paths where you can turn a blind eye and just kind of enjoy where you are and not like risk losing your place, or you can call people on their BS and try to inspire change, try to inspire like others to not sit blindly by when bad things, social things are happening. And I think that's a big movement now. It's why everyone's a little touchy on things on Twitter of what you can say and what you can't say. And I think it all comes down to you just don't want to hurt anyone. You want to create a story that will inspire, but you don't want to hurt anyone in the process.
Right.
That's my take on that.
Right. Exactly. I know. Yeah. I mean, this is why fiction is, you can have a nonfiction book that is, title, front covers, really, really upfront in your face. Here's what we're going to talk about, classism, bigotry, blah, blah, blah. And that can be very informative and very illuminating, and it can really affect your mind and change your knowledge base. But even if it affects your heart, even if it can create some empathy, it's not the same as a fictional story that puts you in the shoes of a person and you literally walk their path and experience it yourself. That's where I think fiction has this beautiful ability to affect the heart. And when your heart is affected, we see this with people like Angelina Jolie or perhaps even Madonna or other people whose names are not coming to mind, but whoever's listening right now might be thinking of some famous person who happened to expose themselves to the painful realities that are all over this planet. And once you walk there and hold people's hands and hug them and talk to them, the idea of getting on your airplane and flying back to your comfortable home and just knowing you're leaving these people in these horrible conditions, that you can't escape that heart effect. And so, and I hope your story will do that for your readers. It will create a heart effect.
Oh, so sweet. Yes, I definitely take fiction to heart a lot. I would say a lot more than like the real world. Sometimes the real world is so much harsher than if you were to, I think we go to a lot of fantasy to escape, and if we can learn at the same time, it's like, whoo, that's good too.
Right.
Because I know I have a problem with this. I think my father did in the past too, with certain truths that are just too hard to look at, and so you create a story around it, and it makes it softer. Like this, the core is still there, but the story is to kind of cushion the really hard parts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know, and that's an example of how story can. And then yep. Humans, brains, hearts, stories. We're interesting creatures. I think that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah,
There you go. That's humans in a
got really
bottle.
deep. We got deep there.
Oh, right, exactly. I think what you're saying is this, it's not always good enough to know something's going on. There's really the question is, what are you going to do about it? Joan Baez has my quote on my email, which is, action is the antidote to despair.
Sure. I love that quote. It's lovely.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit. We're going to go sideways, folks, because there's apparently this, I'll call it a genre, that's sort of booming right now, gaining some enthusiasm, and I think it's really intriguing. It's apparently called monster romance. Listen, what would you call that? You've got rom-com, which is a romantic comedy. Monster romance is like mon-rom.
Monrom. We'll coin that here. Monrom. That sounds terrible.
Monrom. No, I love it. I love it. It's a Monrom. It's totally there. See? Okay, one day we will be the people who coined that term. All right. So tell us a little bit about Ron Mons. No, I did it wrong.
Oh,
Ron Mom Ma. Okay, you're right. It sucks. Okay.
you're making me laugh. All right.
Okay, monster
Okay, so
romance. Tell our
monster.
listeners or talk a little bit about sort of what that is and why people are drawn to that.
Okay. Well, it might not be surprising with all the success surrounding The Shape of Water, which is one of my favorite movies. It's so good. So with a story with supernatural creatures and a human girl, obviously, one of the love interests is gonna be a monster, and oh boy, is he ever one. So I think there's a part of me that's always been able to empathize with the bad guy that is not the typical bad guy in the sense doing bad things, just the bad guy that is looks like a monster, but maybe that's his only aspect. With a lot of stories back in the day, 80s, 90s, sometimes you were just presented with a bad guy who's just a monster and that's it. And I found it, I could empathize with that creature, even though I wasn't supposed to. And so now we're this generation has grown up and started to really look at that archetype of the classic Hollywood horror monster and flip that genre on its head, because it was usually a monster pitted against a classic American hero. And if you empathize with the other in society, or just you feel like a monster yourself, you're gonna like look at that monster differently and look at that classic hero differently. And there's something very interesting going on where, you'll watch the Beauty and the Beast, and you don't want that beast to turn into a human. You love him for just the crazy, hairy person he is. And
Right.
that's, I
Well,
think, is the core of the movement.
no, I think that's such a great point. I mean, one of the worst things about Frankenstein, is that I hate that story. I understand that it was, for people who don't know, it's written by a woman, actually, and there's a fabulous story behind the writing, and it was written at a time when electricity was really being discovered, and people had figured out that you could take like a dead frog leg, and if you put electricity into it, the leg would move. And so, science was playing with this. And so, of course, you get this idea of put a bunch of body parts together, and yay, you create Frankenstein. And Frankenstein is actually the name of the doctor. Dr. Frankenstein creates the monster. I think most people in America think that Frankenstein's actually the monster. I don't know. From the movies, it's what you get. But I have always hated it so much because all I have is massive empathy for the monster who's been, I feel bad for the monster, and then I feel angry that the monster is just inevitably portrayed as, violent and harmful, and then of course all the people in the town hate him, and oh, It really makes me emotionally unhappy for all of those reasons of how this stereotypic, way of people responding, which is probably the whole point of the darn story. So I'm sure it was very successful if I am that uncomfortable. But I think
Probably.
what you're saying is that people are like, we don't want that cut and dry, black and white, right and wrong, good and evil story. We want, what do we want?
I think especially in fiction, we are very drawn to empathizing with characters and putting ourselves in their shoes, and for that, you really need to connect with them. And if you can have that emotional connection, that character could be anything. It could be a spoon. You'd be like, I love you, spoon. It's fine. So if there's something so exciting and fun for me about like monster romance, because it mixes like my two favorite like descriptors of a bad boy with an underdog, and it's just so much fun. And you can recreate so many different monsters. You can pull from the ancient Greeks and lore, or you can make something completely unique and give it the attributes you think it should have. And we've been building up to this, I believe, with starting with the classic horror films, and then Beauty and the Beast, and then Shape of Water, and then I think it's okay to crush on a monster, so to speak, in fiction. And a lot of people are drawn to that.
Well, you've got Damon Salvatore
Demon Salvador.
and the Vampire Diaries,
Ah,
right?
I see. Mm-hmm.
If you haven't watched that, you can watch it as a series. It was written as a book. The books are not worth my time. I tried. I think I got through the first chapter and I went, oh, thank goodness they turned this into a video series. Because the
Oh
video series, which is available on Netflix, is amazing. But Damon Salvatore is like exactly what you said. The, what did you say? Bad boy plus
Well,
the
I was making notes
underdog.
before, and I realized they are the it's a perfect mix of bad boy and underdog. Because everyone loves an underdog, but they also like something that's a little dangerous but safe. It's very interesting.
I know. Trying to write this stuff is challenging. Is there any element of this in your books that you're trying to work on? Are you trying to create any of this? I'm not going to say mon rom ever again. Okay, whether you had any monster romance characters that were actually showing up in your story, because I actually didn't want to assume that they were. I was like, well, just because you love that doesn't mean it's in your story.
Oh, it's in there.
Okay, fun. Go.
Is. I find actually with the stories I plan to create in the future, I seem to kind of keep creating these scenarios where the supernatural creature and a human woman is just it's just my favorite pairing, and I keep seeing I keep going back to that. But without there's a bit of a spoiler with the monster in the first book, so I can't get into too much
No,
detail.
then don't do that.
Oh yeah. So, but her love interest is, in fact, one of these others, and I definitely created a character that would typically be a villain, and not only like well, not so much emotionally, or like he does have some flaws, good flaws, you need some flaws in there, but physically. I've definitely had beta readers who are afraid of him, and I for some it I love that. So I feel like it's okay. And then you have the visual component, what he looks like in your head, and if you can blast past that and see what my main character will eventually see, it makes it all the more interesting. And then you it's another form of their relationship that they have to overcome, as opposed to just all the ups and downs of a typical relationship.
Well, if you think about it, it's sort of like everyone is dangerous. Anyone can end up being, I've been watching Criminal Minds lately. Anyone can end up being a serial killer, And so functionally, what really is like one of the primary necessary ingredients for love? And I think that it's trust. And it's a trust that is so strong that you are willing to open up and be your most vulnerable with someone. So in a way, in writing fiction, a lot of times you want your stories to not be like humdrum, normal, everything's cool. You want the sort of up and down, attention. And so if you make your character particularly hard to trust and particularly scary. Then when the other character actually chooses to trust them, that's like really powerful.
I think I achieved it in this very interesting way where once they finally meet, she's gone through the ringer. She's gone through so much stuff that she doesn't even really kind of so much bat an eye at him. She's like, all right, let's go.
That makes sense. Right.
Because if she wasn't unconditioned and instantly would have met him, that would have made things a little harder to trust.
So she's like, oh, one more monster, whatever. Five more claws.
It's a build up.
Yeah.
It's a build up for it.
Okay, well, that's an interesting way to get around it, too. In a way, she's already started to lose the othering viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. It's like the preconceived notion of what is dangerous versus what looks dangerous and what is actually fine. Because ironically, in the story, a lot of the villains are human and they look totally fine and they're not.
Yeah.
So that's a fun thing to play with. I'm big on contrasts, both in art and like writing. So it's fun for me to create some. I have a character later in the series who is enormous and based on the samurai warrior masks. I found them so cool. I think they're based on Oni, like they're versions of demons, and to see something like that animated, and she's terrified. But in my brain, he sounds like Kelsey Grammer. And it's wonderful.
That's sort of like that's like Spirited Away.
Yeah, that I watched that to death as a teen.
Well, your child is going to be so lucky to be able to grow up on Hayao Miyazaki.
Oh, thank you. He loves it a little bit more than the typical Disney. And I think it has to do with when there's quiet, calm moments in it, it's just rich with a je ne sais quoi, shall we speak.
Yeah, it's hard to explain it, but anyone who's watched Hayao Miyazaki's work, it's just, you're absolutely right. There is something uniquely amazing about his work, and I don't even know how to label why it is so amazing, but it is powerful. Yeah, definitely. So let's see here. Do you feel any pressure from having 5 books in front of you that this publishing company expects you to produce?
I had book one all ready and set to go. Book two was in kind of like disrepair. Books 3, 4, and 5 needed to be written within a couple of months. Mm. So ultimately, I had about a year to get them all in order. And that's fine. Yeah, it was okay. They asked me my opinion on the deadline and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So I might have cut it short. I thought I could get more done with a toddler. It goes to show how much I know myself.
First time parenting.
Yeah.
Yeah, you learn along the way. And to be truthful, there's always that reminder for folks out there that, what is it? Oh, gosh. Someone was talking. It was, once again, I think it was a podcast on the Manuscript Academy. They're so great. And and someone was like, you know what? Never, ever, 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 you know, I said that 5 million more times. Never, ever compare your rough draft to any person out there who, you know, their published work. They're like, you look at their published work and then you look at your rough draft and you moan and groan and pull your hair out because you see the discrepancy. But what you're not looking at is what their rough draft looked like. You know, when they submit it to the publisher, and there were so many things that changed between that and when it actually hit print. So if you are doing 5 books, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're expecting you to show up with like 0 typos and, you know, everything's perfect, right? And what are they looking at? Like annual releases are you looking at?
Let's see. From what they had told me, how we set up the deadline was book one will be, like, say we'll establish a release date. When book one is released, we'll have book two ready for pre-order. And so on. Wow. And it should be like one after the other, like serial releases almost.
Oh my goodness.
Basically the concept, if someone loves book one and they really want to know about the series, ideally they can probably order all of them. which is, interesting and very practical in an age where binge watching and binge reading is very popular. And
I totally get that. I know it's super popular in the self-published groups or community. A lot of times that's talked about as having great value for keeping your audience building and growing. But you have a publisher, you're not self-publishing. So this publisher also wants to basically lean in on the series approach.
yes, they were the ones to encourage the maybe let's break split the books apart. So it seems like series is more their bread and butter, which is nice. It gives me more work to do. It also gives me leeway to not so much rush a story, but take my time and develop it and see all these things I could do with each book
No, that
instead of,
makes a
you have
lot of
to,
sense. Oh my gosh. You know, it's interesting because the Hunger Games trilogy, I really wish had been a four book series, and I wasn't surprised that they made four movies. I felt like I found out about the Hunger Games and about Twilight and about Harry Potter. All of those series I like knew about and wasn't reading because I didn't think they were my type of thing. And with all of them, well, when the fourth book of Harry Potter had already been published, I went down to visit my mom and I saw them sitting on our bookshelf. I'm like, "Mom, you? What? This is like for kids. You know what's going on?" She's like, "Oh, they're great." And I was there for a week and I binge read all four of them while I was there for the week, right? But it was so nice because I got to binge read all four. And I remember thinking, yeah, so you're right. If you really get into something and you don't have to wait 18 months for the next book and the next book and the next book, that's a benefit to the reader. It's very nice for the reader.
Oh yes, and it'll work marketing wise as well, because I like ultimately, you want to make a little cash. That'd be nice.
Yes.
So
Yes.
if you can keep yourself in the reader's conscience, that's a hard word to say, in their mind,
Yep.
and be like, I want to know what's going to happen immediately, then they're going to find out. And I think that's
Okay.
very practical.
Well, this is exciting. I was like, oh, she's got five books. It's going to take like 8 years to read those books. But instead, basically, at some point, the next time, because we're planning to do two interviews, this is a pre-release interview, and then we're going to do one at the other end when you've gone through the whole experience and sort of discuss it. So that's exciting. When we interview next time, I will actually be able to read all five books, it sounds like, or close to, if I'm interested.
If you're interested,
Yay! Well, and I will be. I like your voice. You said that some of your beta readers were surprised at how funny the story was, even though it's dealing with intense topics.
Yes, I think, I have a blurb, and I had images to go along with the manuscript I had to share to get feedback from beta readers. And I think when people think of high fantasy, even though it does have a contemporary feel, it's hard not to go towards Tolkien and think about like serious epics and everything. But I think the 1 foot you'll have in the real world opens this gateway to humor, because fantasy is absurd and we love it for it. So you have that duality going on, and I'm a quirky person, of course. Like a little of my odd humor is going to get in there, and I'm also happy that they find it funny and not too weird. So
Well, but thank God for weird.
yes.
Seriously. Quirky, weird. I mean, we are in a whole different world. Imagine, oh my gosh, all the mental illness that was created by the Victorian era and the late 1800s and all of these incredible strict rules of exactly how you're allowed to be. I mean, yeah.
I'm very good at being weird. That's my go-to thing.
Nice. So let's see here. You said it's character driven versus plot driven. Do you want to explain a little bit to people who are readers more than writers and maybe wondering exactly what that means?
I had to clarify the definition myself, even though like that felt like, this is very character driven. Not only is the plot driven by character choices, it's very focused on developing a character and getting to know them and empathizing with them.
Are you expecting like a year from now you're going to be ready to actually release these books?
believe so. If we continue editing where we are, I think we'll definitely be ready by a year. But I'll be in touch.
Hey, it takes time. Maybe spring 2023. You never
Maybe,
know.
just as long as it's nice and clean, That's what I was worried about when you're saying what are your concerns about the books? It's just I just want things to be consistent so people don't send me tweets going, you have inconsistency right here. And I'm like, thanks, Mom.
Mom, right? Yes, no, the it's funny. I get sometimes I get literal advanced reader copies. They're called ARCs. And of course, these ones have not gone to the final editor or person who's going to make sure everything's perfect. And you're going along, and I was just talking to someone actually earlier this week, and I'm like, wait a minute. I was like, but she sat down already. How can she sit down again? And then I'm go back a couple pages, read every single word. Yeah, she sat down. Dun dun dun. She's sitting down again. She never stood up. Ah, and I'm like, okay, I'm sure they're going to catch
She
that.
sat farther down into a lower seat.
I know. She squished her butt really hard. I know. So yeah, and everyone out there who is going to self-publish, if you are going to do so, do far more editing than you think you need to do, because the traditional publishing world, there are, oh my gosh, the amount of time they put into their edits, the multiple times they do them, and the final edit as a person who's outside who's never seen it before, you know, really it is possible to catch all those edits, or at least catch 99.99999% of them.
I have a suggestion about that. And this also
Go.
comes from book covers.
Yes.
Sometimes I see self-published authors and they have, oh, a little sketchy book cover. And I'm like, oh, you could do better than that, poor dear. Go to your local college or even your local high school. I mean, don't go literally call them because they'll get scared. And ask for the art club or the art department and get a couple students together. And they can make you a cover, give them the credit, maybe like $1.50 and a ham sandwich. They're hungry.
Right.
And they'll make you a beautiful cover that will blow you away.
That is
I feel
such
like,
a good idea.
oh yeah, they always need the credit. So they probably can go the same route for a book club or an English department in a college or high school. And I'm sure they'd love to edit your book.
They're going to be able to flip that book open anytime they want and be like, look, I helped with this. That's nice.
Sure, and they can also put it on a resume. There you go. You're helping each other.
Thank you, Kathleen. That's brilliant advice.
You're welcome. I got one foot in the design world, one foot in creative writing. This is where we meet.
That's right. Okay, so yeah, actually, I do want to know a little bit more about how it was that you were found, ironically, through, I believe it was PitMad, which is part of the Twitter community experience. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, PitMad is a pitch contest that you get to write, you get to pitch your book in a tweet, which is not an easy thing to do because you got a limited amount of characters and you have this book that you have to condense into the really juicy part so you can get attention. It's not always easy to deal with fantasy because boil down fantasy to the basics, it sounds a lot like everyone else's. So you really got to find the good bits that's going to really stand out. And so I was part of this Twitter competition, which basically consists of writing a tweet and using a certain hashtag and
Agents, right?
agents
Got it.
and publishers.
And
And agents
sometimes
and publishers
editors.
will search the hashtag. Yeah, sometimes editors too will find your tweet and they'll like it if they find it interesting. And then you continue from there, you get their contact information. So I had written a tweet that I had focused on what made my fantasy a little different is that there is a male and female platonic relationship. It's just platonic, and I focused on the fact that my main character is a little on the plus side. And my publisher, Scarsdale Publishing, liked it, and it took them a while to get back to me. I had sent them, I believe, the first five chapters in March, and I didn't hear back from them until the summer with a request for a full manuscript. And I thought, this is exciting. Let's see what's going to happen. And from there, they sent me a contract, and I was completely blown away. I got it on my phone, and I read the email, handed the phone to my husband, and just slid off the couch with joy, just laying on the floor. Like, it's happened. Happening. So I don't have an agent. I just work directly with my publisher, which I find very interesting. And I'm curious about how it's going to affect me down the road, whether eventually would I want an agent or would I just like to work with publishers as my on my own. So we'll see. It's been a very kind of, I feel like I had to be in the right place, the right time to get struck by lightning.
Right.
But maybe I'm not giving myself enough credit. I'm not sure.
Well, there's a lot of people probably running around in golf courses holding up their golf clubs in the middle of a lightning storm and hoping to get struck by lightning. So, you're lucky it happened with no effort. Well, okay, lots of
With effort,
effort.
I wrote the tweet.
And you wrote the book. Fair point, fair point. Yeah, okay, well, that's so awesome because you're right, in the writing community, that you get you'll get hundreds, if not, why, I suppose possibly thousands of people sometimes involved in one of those pitch events. And I think they're fabulous personally because I gain so much from just trying to figure out how to boil my story down into a single tweet. And I feel like that is good practice for me as a writer. But some people are like, okay, unless I get 10 people who want me to send them my full, I've failed. And so that's a big part of the world of writing is learning how to actually not take on a I have failed attitude and see yourself as always being on the road forward. That's right. Well, thank you so much again for making the time calling in. And please thank your husband for hanging out with the 2-year-old.
Oh, he knows. He
Well, pass it on. And I will talk to you in about a year or so. Have happy writing moments.
Thank you. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
So, folks, what you're going to want to do, especially if you've just tuned in partway through and caught the end of this and you want to catch the beginning, you just go to marchtwisdale.com, go to the podcast page, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and you're going to find Kathleen's interview. So, go check out the bio. Contact information will be there.